Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Nate and Ed Legg continue their discussion of Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year, with a look at the state of country music during pop's big year. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. Or should I say 80s roll? That's right. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, welcoming back Ed Legg to continue our discussion of Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year. And this week, we're covering the chapter at the 13th Annual International Country Music Fan Fair in Nashville, June 4th through 10th, 1984. Ed, did you make it to the fanfare that year?
I did not, but the year before I was in a press box eating press box food across a table from Kenny Rogers and Miss Marion, his wife from Hee Haw.
Wow.
Because he had it, his ranch was near Athens, and I was covering Georgia football, and I guess he came up and he probably ate in the press box because we were probably less likely to bug him.
That's probably a wise call. I mean, the man was at the top of his field at that point in time.
And absolutely. Printing his own money, basically.
Yep. And inflicting Islands in the Stream on the rest of us, which, you know, it was a massive, massive hit. One of two songs to go platinum, two singles to go platinum in 1983. So, you know, just absolute massive crossover hit written by Barry Gibb and the other Bee Gees. And Dolly Parton, of course, was the co-partner in crime, I think is the appropriate lingo for that one. I'm wrong. Maybe I'm being unfair. I don't know. But that song, man, I have a lot of bad memories associated with that song. I mean, a lot. Like, I think younger kids younger people, but people whose experience of the 80s was like playing with their Masters of the Universe dolls, you know, in the kitchen while they watched their mom doing stuff or taking them to work or whatever, taking them to school on the way to work, get a totally misapprehension of what the 80s were actually like. And the 80s really sucked. I mean, it was the Reagan era. The right-wing backlash was in full effect. The homophobia and racism was off the charts. It was just, and I just associate, you know, waiting for having tires changed some awful place and listening to Islands in the Stream, you know, not listening to it, but having it forcibly placed in my ears. So it was, you know, painful stuff. But the chapter covers
the way Fox News is on in hospital waiting rooms now.
Yes. Yes.
Not that that's bad. I'm kidding. But
yeah, of course. Of course. But it was.
It is bad.
It is all bad. But The chapter doesn't start with that. The chapter starts with the fanfare with an announcement that Willie Nelson will be signing autographs at the CBS Records booth. Oh no, he won't. Like that's the, and I mean, obviously Matas wasn't there, and he's doing the stuff from articles. So he found some article that had that little touch of Willie Nelson's going to be there, and no, he's not. But they talk about Kenny and Dolly, of course, but they also talk about Willie, and Willie was the biggest star in this period, and it's a country star in this period. And it's interesting, but it's true. Willie was by far the biggest pop crossover artist out of all these characters. I mean, bigger than Dolly, even bigger than Kenny Rogers, because, you know, as big as, say, the Gambler was in the 70s or Coward of the County, Willie was even bigger. You know, he didn't even perform on Lukenbach, Texas, but it mentioned his name. So, you know, and it was just one of many hits. And I think he didn't talk about the Merle Haggard crossover duet that Willie had in 83, Poncho and Lefty, that was a massive hit. And I think also a crossover hit to some degree. But of course, in this season, Willie is really pushing To All the Girls I've Loved Before. I guess he didn't really have to push it. He just put it out there, a duet with Julio Iglesias. And this thing was, I mean, that single was omnipresent. And sad, it pains me to say this, but it wasn't any better than I Live on the Stream. Am I wrong?
The only thing better was that Willie was singing on it.
That's true. Willie had cool points, but you know, Dolly's as cool as Willie, or close. Maybe not.
Well, that's
quite
true. That's true.
But she's,
you're right.
She's universally beloved, yeah. And yet,
yeah, that's true.
You know, that,
and talented like Willie is. She's yeah, a franchise like Willie is, too. You're right.
And you know, I don't want to diss Kenny Rogers. I love Coward of the County, which is a testament to my own bad taste, but. You know, he had Kenny Rogers in the first edition in the 60s with Check It In to See What Condition My Condition Was In. And I think,
yeah,
you know, he didn't write that, obviously, but it was a massive hit and, you know, long career. But by the early 80s, Kenny Rogers had really curdled. He and Lionel Richie were threatening to become one person and just inflict endless pablum on everybody. And Lionel Richie, I mean, he was in the Commodores. They were badass. And you know, something happened around this time, and Matos will come to Lionel Richie later, but Kenny and Lionel were circling each other and perfecting this kind of post-rock pop that's going to become, you know, the dominant medium, or one of the dominant forms of pop in the 2000s. But the whole tradition of Mariah Carey and Celine Dion and what we call pop now, I think, really comes from this period. And Barry Gibb, his work with Barbara Streisand in the 70s, I think, was absolutely crucial to that blend. And maybe you could even blame Willie Nelson for some, I don't know that you blame, but, you know, I don't know. There was an interesting thing going on. And one thing that was interesting was, you know, Matos has a quote from somebody, from Jimmy Bowen, who was like the king of Nashville. And at this time, the record exec that was the king of Nashville. And he was saying, you know, the reason that you had so much pop crossover in the early 80s was because the pop market was on its knees and it was really struggling. And so country was kind of filling in the gap. And then when pop got its act together in 84, country's back to the fanfare in Nashville, you know, where it belongs. So, well, I guess we should go ahead and play our first song. And this is, of course, Willie Nelson and Julio Iglesias, To All the Girls I've Loved Before. And that was Willie Nelson and Julio Iglesias duetting on To All the Girls I've Loved Before. And you know, of course, Matos shares Willie's cover story, which he told on multiple award shows. I didn't take much clicking around researching this episode to find an award show where Willie Nelson is telling the story of how he claims that he heard Julio on the radio in London, didn't know who he was, and just loved that voice and had to do a duet with him. And then his wife tells him he's one of the biggest sellers on earth. I'm sure that had nothing to do with Willie's desire to do a duet with him. But, you know, it was an interesting career move, and it was an interesting period. I mean, you know, Willie obviously started doing duets with Waylon Jennings, and then, you know, he's done duets with Ray Price and George Jones and Merle Haggard and Johnny Paycheck and many others. But by this point, he's just doing duets with pretty much anybody and getting bigger and bigger. And I think Montas has a great sentence here that he says, by 1984, Willie had pulled off the most unheard of type of crossover, completely ubiquitous, yet so subtle that no one minded. And I've never really heard anybody complaining about Willie Nelson being overexposed. I mean, I'm sure somebody hates Willie Nelson, but I've never encountered this person. Have you ever come across anybody who hates Willie?
No. And I mean, the thing that about Willie that I can't quite transcend is that my dad's best friend he worshiped him to the point that one time we were watching SNL and Willie came on. And the next day, my dad was talking to my his friend about it, and his friend was furious that he didn't call him that instant, which at that, you know, it was midnight on the East Coast, and his friend's mad because my dad didn't call him because Willie was on there. I mean, that's how much he loved Willie. And it kind of ruined, you know, when your dad, I mean, I'm from the generation gap generation, and when your dad's liking this stuff or your dad's friend, it's making it harder for me, but I still adore him, you know, and he's unimpeachable, which I think Dolly is too. I think that's really a good comparison. Why didn't they do a duet? Or maybe they did.
I'm sure they did some duets, but nothing's jumping out at me. Maybe Steph can Google, but yeah, that does seem like an unusual missed opportunity there. But I think that, yeah, you'd think that they would have crossed. I do have to catch, Matos, though. He has a very rare mistake that I caught. And you know, a general interest music book like this, it's inevitable that the writer is going to make a mistake because you're covering so many topics. Nobody is an expert on every topic, and people can make mistakes on the topic they are expert on, you know, and just not catch it in the editing or whatever. But this is pretty minor, but he mentions that he kind of gives a summary of Willie's career and says he was a songwriter turned performer in the 60s, but that's not actually correct. He was always a performer. It's just that he had massive commercial success as a songwriter while he was still pretty much struggling as a performer. He wrote hits for Ray Price and Patsy Cline and Farron Young and others that were massive, massive country hits in the late 50s and early 60s, Nightlife and Crazy and others. But he had been, you know, I've done many episodes on Willie with his biographer, Jonick Potoski, and Willie was performing from the get. So it was, anyway, I don't know. I'm just rubbing Matos' face in it because he knows so much that.
There you go.
And I know he's listening. But one thing I didn't know about was this Kenny Rogers and Sheena Easton duet from 1983, We've Got Tonight, which was number one country in 83, a Bob Seger song. And I went and played that. I don't think I'd ever heard that song before. Were you familiar with this Kenny Rogers Sheena Easton duet?
Absolutely. Yes, because I had that Bob Seger album that was on, which was one of my less proud album purchases looking back now, from 1978. So I knew that song. And I mean, when that song, I remember when it came out, and it was on that same radio station in Columbus, Georgia, that, you know, the hit station. And so it was, and she was, you know, then she did the Prince thing right after that, or pretty soon after that, 85, I think it was early 85 when that Prince produced thing came on. You know what I'm talking about?
Nate, you're muted. Nate.
Oops.
My bad. That was 87.
Oh, it was?
Sugar Walls might have been 86, but but You've Got the Look was 87 for sure, because it was on right, sign at right. the time.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Sugar Walls.
But Sheena did, I would call that Sheena Easton's heel turn, because she came out with My Baby Takes the Morning Train. Remember that? That was her first song.
Yeah.
And I remember Casey Kasem giving that endless attention. And then this duet with Kenny Rogers that I have no memory of, which is really odd. But, and it's weird because I was being forced to hear a lot of country music in this period, and somehow I missed that song. When I heard it, I was like, I don't have any memory of hearing it before. But anyway, it was interesting. I mean, Sheena Easton was like the ultimate kind of pop chameleon in this period, and then does her heel turn in the late 80s when she starts working with Prince and doing more kind of sexually explicit stuff, and obviously, you know, a very erotic duet with Prince, who's, you know, inherently scandalous, plus the whole interracial aspect. So I don't know, I've got some admiration for Sheena Easton, and I'm kind of curious what became of her in the rest of her career. But I guess after you've worked with Kenny Rogers, you're ready for anything. It's kind of
okay. Well, I mean, again, he was at that point that no matter what he did, he actually got into photography. And again, this was something that people my parents' age bought. It was his book of photographs of famous people. And it wasn't Danny Leibovitz, I'll tell you that.
And he also had the Kenny Rogers chicken, which is immortalized on Seinfeld. And yes, Dolly and Willie actually did a duet on Willie's song Pretty Paper, which was a hit for Roy Orbison in 1963, written by Willie. But that's pretty recent that Dolly and Willie did that. So they didn't do a duet in their high water mark in the 80s. But so then he gives some background on the fanfare and also its role in the tourism industry in Nashville. So, you know, you had Opryland, which was built by the Grand Ole Opry, a complete music amusement park. You also had Conway Twitty's Twitty City and Music Village. Dolly Parton had her own retreat and amusement park that talks about the Bill Monroe Bluegrass Museum, which opened that year. And so that tourism in Nashville, country music tourism, drew 7.4 million tourists in 1984. And I don't think it's slowed down since. And it's so funny, and I had no idea about this until I started doing Let It Roll, but in the 30s, 40s, 50s, the town elders of Nashville were really pretty embarrassed by the whole country music thing. And it really took the tourism of people coming down to see the Grand Ole Opry on Saturday night becoming an undeniable piece of, you know, the city budget. And it's just funny to me that the town fathers of Nashville, the Athens of the South, as they say, fancy it, you know, were so down on country music. But by this point, they've given up, and country music was one of the dominant industries of Nashville, and people like Roy Acuff were, you know, city fathers by that point. But the fanfare specifically was formed by three sisters from Colorado, Ludilla, Loretta, and Kay Johnson. So Kay kind of got ripped there. I mean, Ludilla and Loretta, those are pretty awesome names, especially for people who are going to found not just one country music fan club, but the IFCO, the International Fan Club Organization. Like they started out, I guess, as was it Dolly Parton or Loretta Lynn fans started one fan club. And then by the 80s, they had this IFCO, which had umbrellaed 250 different country music fan clubs. So these ladies were like the queens, the empresses of country music fan clubs. And they started the fanfare, and I thought this was pretty hilarious. They started the fanfare basically to get fans to come to it instead of the DJ convention in Nashville, because it was too crowded and the DJs, you know, had payola to collect, I presume.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, business is business, and you got to keep the business and the fans, you know, a little bit separate. But I don't know. I think this is a pretty good way to cover country music. You know, you're going to have to. I mean, it was a big chunk of the music biz in 1984. And let's go ahead and hear our next act. This is one of the new traditionalists that are going to start revolutionizing country music through this period, all the way through the early 90s. And this is Reba McEntire, Before I Met You, from her My Kind of Country album. And that was Reba McEntire's Before I Met You, the first song on her My Kind of Country album. And they talk, Matos talks about that in this chapter, and he brings up Jimmy Bowen, who, like I said, is kind of the capo di tutti capo of Nashville record executives, which is funny because in the 60s, he was originally the Youngblood producer at Frank Sinatra's Reprise Records. And he's the guy who kept Frank Sinatra on the pop charts in the 60s with things like Something Stupid, his duet with his daughter Nancy, Strangers in the Night, which Frank hated. That whole he got Dean Martin to the top of the charts. He's the guy who hooked up Lee Hazelwood with Nancy Sinatra, and then had the second career in Nashville, where I think Montes must have talked about him in an earlier chapter, because I can't think of what book I would know this from. I've got a Jimmy Bowen autobiography that I haven't read yet, but I've got it on my shelf. But you know, at this point, he's sort of serial taking over different record labels and firing everybody and cleaning the decks. He's kind of like the alpha A&R man in all of Nashville. He's the guy who gets rid of the other A&R men. But he has this reputation as this like completely commercially minded hack. And yet he's the guy who let Reba McEntire switch producers and bring in Harold Shedd and choose her own songs for My Kind of Country. And he just did it because he had, you know, had one plan for her. And then she walked into his office and met with him and totally changed his mind. So I think it's a testament to Jimmy Bowen's A&R skills that he wasn't a one size fits all kind of producer or A&R guy. I think by this time he was way beyond being a producer, but he didn't try to force her into being doing Islands in the Stream type stuff. He let her do this country stuff, and I think it's really just the two songs that we've played, the difference between Before I Met You, where you're actually hearing fiddles, and you know, there's other tracks where you hear dobros and steel guitars and you know, it's actual country music. And I remember when Reba and George Strait and others started, you know, Randy Travis was, Ricky Skaggs actually was before them. And Randy Travis comes along a little later. But it was just, you know, this new traditionalist movement that for me, sweeping the floor at the Oklahoma Tire and Supply where I had my first job, like it was such an improvement over the synthesizer heavy fake country that dominated this whole era. Do you remember when you first noticed these new traditionalists?
You know, that's a loaded question for me. I'll put it this way. If I had bought, if I brought Ashley Judd home, to meet my mom would have been over the moon. If I'd brought home Wynonna, my mom would have been over me. So I am a city boy, but what you're saying, I mean, she's authentic. I think, I mean, isn't Reba who she really is? And isn't that what Dolly is? And that's what Willie is, you know, these authentic people, which I mean, I think Willie is a traditionalist. And maybe he isn't, but I mean, he doesn't sound like a fake country. He doesn't sound like Keith Urban.
No. Although, you know, I wouldn't knock Urban too much. I mean, but that's a whole separate topic. But the thing about Willie,
yes,
is that the outlaw movement simultaneously was sort of a neo-traditionalist movement in the 70s, and it was a big crossover movement because it was this generation of country guys coming to terms with rock and roll. And Waylon Jennings in particular was, I mean, he played bass with Buddy Holly, and literally on Bill, right. Buddy Holly's last tour. So he was always a rocker. And when he made his big break in Tucson, it was, you know, more rock and roll than what Buck Owens and Merle Haggard were doing in Bakersfield. And Nashville tried to force him into this country folk bag that was an awkward fit for Waylon. And they didn't have any idea what to do with Willie through that whole period. And so in the 70s, when they got their freedom, their stuff was, you know, closer to rock and roll than traditional country, and yet it was truer to the spirit of traditional country than the countrypolitan stuff that they were competing with. So Willie's kind of an odd case as a crossover artist. But then you hear stuff like, I mean, I love their version of Pancho and Lefty, but it's very synthesizer heavy and very 80s production style. And of course, what he's doing with Julio Iglesias is 100% 80s production style.
Yeah.
And so when Reba and George Strait come along and they're doing fiddles and doing these pretty dry production styles, not a lot of reverb, just, you know, Beatles style dry instruments, really cut through. And like, you know, you mentioned the Judds, and he talks about the Judds quite a bit, Naomi and Winona, the mother and daughter duet. And one thing I learned here I didn't know was that their given names were Diana and Christina, respectively. And they rebranded themselves Naomi and Winona Judd pretty cleverly, I think. I mean, it definitely.
I agree. Yeah. It makes them seem more country, like the women who started the fan club organization.
Yeah,
you know, they've got more country names then. How much do you think Outlaw set up the new traditionalists, or did it have anything to do with it at all?
Well, it did and it didn't. I mean, I think that the outlaw country guys were self-conscious posers in a way. Like you know, Waylon would have his Telecaster with that leather, like he had a Telecaster that somehow had been covered in leather, the hand embossed, you know, leather, and always wears black and the big hat. And Willie, you know, always had the bandana and the ponytails. And, you know, then you get characters like David Allan Coe that are just completely over the top with that kind of image stuff.
Yeah.
And
the,
you know, Hank Williams Jr. kind of rode that outlaw wave too, when he rebranded himself as his own person rather than being a revival act for his dad. You know, I don't know. That's an interesting question. Let's take the sponsor break and let me mull that, and I'll come back with some brilliant insights.
All right.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Actually, my impression is that the new traditionalists really came more out of the bluegrass scene. And also, like, Ricky Skaggs was straight out of the bluegrass scene. And John Anderson was also, not the bluegrass scene, but very much a traditional country artist. And the way they positioned themselves, you know, George Strait dressed like a real cowboy, but the kind of real cowboy that you might see at Texas Tech or Texas State, you know, not the kind of cowboy like Waylon Jennings that you might see hanging out with the Bandidos or the Hells Angels, like a very different sort of preppier, mellower kind of, it was a very 80s sort of thing, like, you know, button down shirts and stuff, even with the cowboy boots and the cowboy hat. So it didn't have that self-conscious, I'm on the edge or I'm close to rock and roll vibe at all. It was very moving away from rock and roll. I don't know. I mean, I definitely think that the outlaw movement and then the swing back towards pop country, you know, you had the outlaw movement from like totally dominant from like 76 to 80. And then you kind of had the urban cowboy movement, which is this pop country thing. I mean, Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places and that whole ethos. And actually Austin and Houston had kind of rival country scenes. And urban cowboy was a pretty accurate reflection of what Mickey Gilley and others were doing in the Houston scene that was very different from the Austin scene, which had a lot of like folk singer type crossovers, like people like Jerry Jeff Walker that came from the folk, the pop folk, you know, the Kingston Trio kind of tradition or whatever, at the Greenwich Village folk singing tradition, and then had gone to Austin and kind of turned country. And then Willie and Waylon came along and kind of took over that scene and took it national in a big way. And then you had the urban cowboy movement, which synced up with Dolly going disco and Kenny Rogers going pop country and you know, becoming this dominant force, and his alliance with Barry Gibb and Lionel Richie and these other pop figures. So that I would say that the new traditionalists were more a reaction against the Kenny Rogers era stuff than they had anything to do with the outlaw movement. The outlaw movement was, you know, by that time Waylon and the gang are playing stadiums, or not stadiums, but arenas, big theaters, and sometimes stadiums. So they, you know, it wasn't a direct reaction to that, I wouldn't say. But then let's see what's next to cover. This is kind of a short chapter, and I think he could have covered you know, there's a few more artists he could have covered. I think John Anderson and Ricky Skaggs, like I mentioned, are both pretty notable in this period. But essentially, I think covering The Judge, Reba, and George Strait, you kind of get the new traditionalist thing. And then the Jimmy Bowen stuff gives you kind of the biz guy perspective on it. But then he raps with the dreaded, the hated Lee Greenwood, God Bless the USA. Now, Don, I don't even want to know the first time you heard it. I want to know what's the most recent time you've had this inflicted on you.
Oh, God. Well, you know what's really, I hate to pull this in, but I have, you know, I have a connection to Lynyrd Skynyrd, and I
wanted to see them.
Yeah, I wanted to see them in their, you know, the incarnation. I don't really think of them as Lynyrd Skynyrd, but I went and saw them in 2014, and that has turned into something that would fit right in with Lee Greenwood. And here's why. They've turned Freebird into like an American anthem. They've started using the bald eagle. And that's been going on for a while. And that's just deeply disturbing to me. And it's so post-Gulf War. You know, it's kind of that whole thing. And I mean, I've heard it at baseball games. That's my country music loving wife, you know, loves it when it comes on because she can kind of give me a hard time because she sees me turning green, you know, and not because I like Lee Greenwood. But and I mean, is that enough? Is that tell you enough?
Because I think that sets up my latest trauma tale of it, which was taking my kid to a Cub Scout camp out on the USS Livingston. And you know, you spend the night in this giant aircraft carrier, and this thing is enormous and it's haunted. It is absolutely haunted. It is creepy and it's huge. And you walk around in the bowels of this thing, and you know, there's lots of dark passageways you do not go down, but there's lots of lit passageways that you go and take the tour. And they have like a screaming mannequin, like they have this dentist office set up where they show you the World War II dentist just horrifically yanking teeth out of some poor soldier's head, you know, sailor's head. And they've got a recording of this guy screaming. And so my little kid was terrorized because we're walking through this ghostly haunted aircraft carrier. And then, of course, at the big muster, everybody has to stand in line with their troop and their pack and all this stuff. And of course they play God Bless the USA and turn it into a full-on fascist rally. And it was just like, you know,
yeah,
it was brutal, you know, after like 3 hours of sleep on these hideously uncomfortable bunk beds and eating the worst food ever. And then they whip out the God Bless the USA and just with no mercy whatsoever. And It's very much an 80s song. Like, I mean, I remember, do you remember Dare?
Yeah, Dare of course.
To keep kids off drugs. And they would, now you were in high school in the 70s. Were they doing that kind of crap in the 70s?
No, they didn't do, Dare didn't start until the 80s, for sure.
Yeah.
And there was some, they were still using scare tactics. And then some of then Campus Crusades started kind of getting in, kind of worm their way in a real weird kind of almost obtuse way. They played us this video with the Eagles' Desperado on it. And I could never figure out what were they trying to do. Were they trying to get us to be Christians or trying to get us off drugs?
Well, even Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, resorts to the higher power card. But my first exposure to that particular brand of brainwashing was the guy who claimed, at least, that he was the real life inspiration for Beretta. And his gig had devolved into traveling around elementary schools and middle schools and giving these sort of scared straight speeches. And of course, he's a Brooklyn guy. Like, he wasn't a country person. But the next year, we had the full-on Dare rally, which was an absolute fascist, no holds barred, using drugs to terrorize people. And the hypocrisy of it, like, I was totally falling for this. Like, I was the kind of kid who was like, oh, yeah, that Mike Tyson, he's a total clean liver, you know? Like, oh, Ozzy's quit drugs, you know? I mean, I believed it all. Like, oh, Run DMC would never touch this stuff, you know? I just thought everybody had renounced drugs, and I had no idea that the 80s were like the cocaine and LSD era until I get to college and see this stuff firsthand. But and it seemed like every drug dealer I knew in the late 80s or early 90s had a Dare t-shirt that they would bust out.
Yes. Yes. Chris Robinson from the Black Crowes wore one when he was in Vanity Fair with Goldie Hawn's daughter, who's now in Kate Hudson. When those two lovebirds got together, their photo in Vanity Fair, he was wearing that Dare t-shirt.
It became this classic irony thing. But God bless the USA. Yes. Never got that full ironic treatment, because the people who take it seriously have never let it go. I mean, it is still this anthem. I mean, 1984 was, I guess, a year or two before Oliver North became a celebrity, testifying about how he had bought missiles from the Iranians and then used them to fund the Contras in South America. And he didn't mention the whole part about the, you know, shipping cocaine to Los Angeles to fund all this. But it had that same feeling where I watched this thing on TV and I came away like, wow, this guy's this total evil criminal. I bet people are going to be really mad. And then I come to school the next day and everybody loves Oliver North, you know? Like, they're waving flags and saying, if you don't love Oliver North, I'm going to punch you. And that was exactly the ethos that God Bless the USA just absolutely captured. And I don't know if you've looked at Lee Greenwood, like gone back and looked at some of his videos and stuff from the 80s. And he dresses like he's in a Huey Lewis cover band. You know, there's no country aspect to this at all. And yet, he's more true to the country ethos in some ways than anybody else. I mean, it's really fascinating stuff. I think this is going to end up being a shorter episode because it's a shorter chapter, but this Lee Greenwood phenomenon, I'm not going to play God Bless the USA. You can go hear that on your own dime, but let's go ahead and hear Lee Greenwood's Going Gone, which went number one country. And this is as pop country as it gets.
It's over, I left the door unlocked again, but this time someone new walked in, while she was all alone,
and he told. And that was Lee Greenwood doing Going Gone, which was number one country for him off the Somebody's Gonna Love You album, his first album, which Matos quotes somebody saying, we should have called it Lee Greenwood's greatest hits. And if only he'd stopped there, because, you know, he goes on to produce God Bless the USA. I also thought it was classic that he literally came out of Las Vegas. Like, this guy was a Las Vegas lounge entertainer who, as Mato says, his range extended from soft rock to soft country. And I mean, yeah, that just sums up everything. I don't know. Any more trauma tales about Lee Greenwood? Or,
well, do you think that it was there always, and this my wife says nowadays, and she is a country music fan and she grew up in the country. And her mom, who my wife grew up in a rural farm area in Wisconsin. And she says that every country star nowadays has a song about veterans or a song about a patriotic song, but it's more connected to the soldier experience. I mean, is this how this did, was he planting that seed? Was that, because it fit right into the whole, go ahead.
That, well, the Travis Tritt sort of, here's a quarter called Somebody Who Cares, and the attacks on the the formerly Dixie Chicks, now the Chicks, around 2003. Yeah. And yeah, you know, but that reactionary strain has two source rivers vis-a-vis country music. There's the whole Sergeant Barry What's-His-Face and the Ballad of the Green Berets in 66.
Okay.
Or 65, yeah. 66, which wasn't country music at all. It was straight up jingoism on the pop charts, but it was usually popular with country fans. And then Merle Haggard does Okie from Muskogee as a joke, tongue completely in cheek. Like, they were smoking pot on the bus when they drove through Muskogee. And that's where the whole we don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee thing came from. And as in my episode with Dave Cantwell, I learned that Merle was going to follow that up with a song, Irma Jackson, about interracial love, which would have been the smart play. But his record label, Capitol, didn't want to let him do that and push back. And Merle kind of folded and comes back with Fight Inside of Me, which is completely reactionary, love it or leave it, kind of, you know, I'm going to punch you, hippie. Which I can certainly see the appeal of. You know, I'm a punk rocker, so I viscerally feel the whole I'm going to punch you hippie in a real way. But then Merle, of course, you know, by 2003 is sort of on the left wing of all this. And, you know, it's one of the people trying to push back against Travis Tritt and those guys. But, you know, then the whole bro country movement has been essentially sort of repackaging 70s Southern rock or just any kind of rock, really more like 80s hair metal.
Yes.
In a way.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And that's a totally normal thing for country music to do. Country has always been kind of like the place where Americans look back at the past one last time. Like, you know, whether it's Uncle Dave Macon doing, you know, minstrel songs from the 1890s as country songs in the 1920s, all the way to basically rewriting Sweet Home Alabama as a big country hit just 2 or 3 years ago. And I can't remember the name of the song that's like a complete rip of Sweet Home Alabama that was on the country charts. But what I wanted to do, since this chapter was kind of short, was run through the number one country hits that year and see what else was going on that Matos doesn't get into. And like George Strait is You Look So Good in Love. So, you know, covered that. Then T.G. Shepherd, Slow Burn, and T.G. Shepherd's definitely, and John Conley, in my eyes, they were definitely part of that early 80s era. And then Crystal Gayle and Ronnie Millsap, they were right there with Kenny Rogers in that whole period. Then you've got Merle Haggard doing Lefty for Sales, That's the Way Love Goes, which was originally a hit for Johnny Rodriguez in the 70s. And so Merle was a perennial by this point, but was still had a strong run in the 80s. And then Ricky Skaggs with Don't Cheat in Our Hometown. So one of the preeminent new traditionalists right there with a massive hit. And then Don Williams, who was one of these, he was kind of like the country version of James Taylor or that kind of soft rock. I love Don Williams, but you know, he's coming out of that early 70s kind of James Taylor, Cat Stevens kind of vibe, just has a cowboy hat on. And here's Going, Going, Gone from Lee Greenwood. But one, and he doesn't talk about the Statler brothers who had a hit with Elizabeth. So I don't know that they needed to be talked about, but I'm seeing Alabama and Oak Ridge Boys, which he's not covered either. And that was definitely a major factor. And Alabama in particular was epitomizing that sort of reactionary trend that that we're talking about here. I think for that time, I don't know. Did you ever, like, I never gave the Oak Ridge Boys in Alabama a chance. I'm probably wrong about that, but I found Elvira just, Steph's loving Elvira, but I found it just immensely painful to take.
No, you know what's weird? Do you remember Alabama's, The Closer You Get was on Friday Night Videos.
They had
a video on. I mean, that was my exposure to them, and it was intriguing. They were from, I want to say they were from Fort Payne, Alabama. They were from near where my first job was, so I mean, they were kind of around. Although they're kind of like Hootie and the Blowfish. I think they got huge in Myrtle Beach. And I'm really talking kind of way out of my league. But they did come to my attention. I had friends in college who liked Alabama. And they definitely had a brand that, kind of a bro brand. Like one of them was in the same fraternity as my next door neighbor. And they, you know, one of their albums, they were all pursuing their hobbies and everything. And then that seems like another band that just was printing money by that time.
Yes, they absolutely were. They absolutely were. And also, just to, you know, just using Confederate iconography straight up, unapologetically.
There you go.
Unironically. Yeah. But without seeming racist. You know, it's just the kind of thing you could get away with. I mean, Hank Williams Jr. had a song called "If the South Would Have Won, We'd Have Had It Made." And my boss at the Oklahoma Tire and Supply Company would finish that verse with a line including the N-word, and we'd all have a blank slave. And I remember just thinking, this is fucking evil, you know? This is wrong. In the 80s, you could just get away with that shit. It was amazing. But let's go ahead and hear our next song. This is George Strait's Amarillo by Morning.
Amarillo by morning, up from San Antonio. Everything that I got is just what I've got on. When that sun is high in that Texas sky, I'll be bucking it to county.
And that was George Strait's Amarillo by Morning, which I picked because I'm from the Texas Panhandle and there aren't many songs about Amarillo. So, I don't know if they played that as much not in the Texas Panhandle, but you could not get away from that song in the Texas Panhandle, I have to tell you. Like, they played that shit all the time. And I liked it. I liked George Strait all the way through. But, you know, going back to looking at the charts, like, you see Julio and Willie in their duet. And then also Eddie Raven, who was a big pop rocker around that time. And one song that wasn't a hit this year, but was on the radio constantly, Juice Newton.
Oh, Juice Newton? I was going to ask you where you think Juice Newton felt fit in, because she started
Queen of Hearts
doing more pop after that.
Yeah, Queen of Hearts Angel of the Morning. She's one of the definitive urban cowboy era pop country people, along with Eddie Raven, that were truly rockers. I mean, you know, but I loved Angel of the Morning and Queen of Hearts. They were just badass. But you were still hearing that stuff on the radio constantly to this whole period.
Yes, you were.
Very true. You know, so it wasn't like it had gone away. And so this stuff like, you know, the George Strait or the Reba or the Ricky Skaggs or John Anderson that might be breaking through, it would be coming through a thick veil of Kenny Rogers and Crystal Gayle and Alabama and Oak Ridge Boys and Lee Greenwood. And it was a treat, you know, the real hardcore country stuff, you know, sounded a treat. And it's funny, the more I learn about this stuff, I just thought the Oak Ridge Boys were some hideous pop country confection. And yet it turns out they were legit gospel artists on the white gospel side of the line, and had put in like well over a decade of working that circuit before they went into country. And like somebody like Ronnie Millsap, that I just thought was just, I had everything I'd heard on the radio, and I heard a lot of Ronnie Millsap on the radio, I did not like, and I just thought it was pop country and insufferable. And then I find out he's like really a Memphis blue-eyed soul singer, blind, so blue-eyed might be an unfortunate sort of phrase to refer to Ronnie Millsap, but apologies there. But that's what he was. He was a white guy who sang blues and R&B, and went country just because that was kind of the market he could get into. He never had any luck trying to go the R&B rocker route. I think he was just too late to the party for that. But he had a very successful country career, and it turns out he's a pretty respected musician. So, you know, it's amazing what kind of ignorance you can wallow in for years.
That's like Glenn Campbell, who's a great guitar player, and I think one of the brilliant stylists of all time. And I would never have thought that. I mean, and actually, I really enjoy Hank Jr. I mean, I really enjoy his style when I'm not getting fed his bullshit.
Exactly. That's the same thing with David Allan Coe. Like, Long-Haired Redneck is one of my favorite songs. And the only time I've ever had a chance to see David Allan Coe, it was in Austin in the 90s at a club that was, I knew as soon as I went in there, and it was full of Pikes, which is a fraternity, that these guys would all wear ropers, and that's a kind of boot, and they all had money, and it was like every one of them's dad was like the county attorney of somewhere, and they travel in these giant packs, and they would wreck your shit if you got crosswise with them or even just came to their attention. And as soon as I go into the Black Cat and it's full of Pikes, I'm like, oh, this is not what I was expecting. And Coe has a whole album of like racist, sexist obscenities that he would sell out of the trunk of his car. And that was what he was playing, was these songs off that. And, you know, I had to leave before I was killed by Pikes. You know, it's very painful and embarrassing as a Southerner and somebody of Scots-Irish descent, which is more commonly known as rednecks, to be associated with these people who cannot give it up. And, you know, the Williams family were not slavers. They were not wealthy Southern aristocrats. They were trash, just like my family were, picking cotton and you know, falling for the old scam of you're better than the black people, like that's all you have to give us is just that one thing, and then we'll run with it. And it's just so embarrassing. And you know, that's one thing that was important about people like Willie Nelson and Johnny Cash and Waylon Jennings and Merle Haggard too, was that they were explicitly anti-racist. And, you know, Willie in particular was a big advocate for Charlie Pride and, you know, other black performers in country music. And it was a big part of the whole 70s feeling of kind of we're healing, you know, after all the unrest of the 60s. But it was also, sadly, I think kind of functioned to make everybody think, well, we solved that problem. Now we can go back to being our stupid asshole selves.
Yeah.
And that's where you get Lynyrd Skynyrd, who, you know, Ronnie Van Zant in the 70s was clever enough to have somebody like Robert Christgau mulling his lyrics and wondering and giving him the benefit of the doubt over and over again. And, you know, Ronnie Van Zant, of course, died in 1977 in a plane crash, so that when Rossington and Collins, or Collins in particular, who just passed away, was running the band in the 90s and 2000s, they just took that stuff in the most jingoistic direction, like you were talking about.
Yeah.
And went so far with it that documentary they made, they worked really hard to try to deny that. Like, they realized that
that's true.
They had overshot.
It's almost like they... Yeah, that was the theme, was like, well, you don't really know Lynyrd Skynyrd. And, you know, the beginning, they're showing people on the front row, and then they're showing that eagle, you know, the golden eagle on the piano and all that. And they're saying, there's this Lynyrd Skynyrd you don't know. That's the only Lynyrd Skynyrd that matters. And that's why they're still playing all but two of their songs are those Lynyrd Skynyrd songs from their Ronnie Van Zant songs.
Yeah.
You know, so...
So we've kind of gone far afield from country of 1984, but this is just the kind of stuff for crackers like ourselves, if I can include
there you go.
In that category, that we have to deal with when these topics come up. You know, we're here to talk about Prince and Michael Jackson and Bruce Springsteen and Madonna and everything, and Matos brings up the country ghost out of our closet, or the skeleton out of our closet, and we have to confront this stuff. And so, you know, the takeaways are everybody loves Willie. we still love Dolly Parton, even though she totally went pop country in this period. And honestly, like I said, I like plenty of the pop country. Eddie Rabbit had plenty of fun songs, and Crystal Gayle had some good songs, and Juice Newton definitely had some good songs. But nonetheless, that stuff was played out by 1984, and Lee Greenwood is like the rotten, you know, broccoli fart left over after that party. And people like,
it's not a good turn.
no, it's not. And yet the next generation is apparent and is here. The Judds, Reba McEntire, Ricky Skaggs, George Strait, those folks are having hits with this new traditionalist sound that's going to carry country all the way until it's going to carry country into the Garth Brooks era. It's actually what's going to spawn Garth Brooks, who's going to then, and not that I think it's anything he did, but just his commercial success destroyed that era. And so country is about to go on a pretty exciting run. And it's interesting, like pop is having a great year in 1984. And I would say country is having a transitional year. So any final thoughts on the country of 84?
No. You know, I'm glad I was thinking about Juice Newton. I'm glad you brought her up. And then she did Tell Her No. That was her follow-up to, and I don't know if it was a follow-up to Queen of Hearts or the other one,
Angel of the Morning. And the crazy thing is that Juice Newton's either Queen of Hearts or Angel of the Morning was actually put out as a double A-side by Capitol Records with Sheena Easton's Bond theme for Your Eyes Only, which is the weirdest pairing but makes perfect sense. And then, you know, you find out that Sheena Easton and Kenny Rogers are having this huge duet, which I still cannot believe I missed. And I know, I knew the Bob Seger version. As soon as I heard it, I was like, oh, that's a Bob Seger song. But somehow, I swear I've never heard this Kenny Rogers, Sheena Easton song, which seems impossible because I spent the 70s and 80s listening to country radio non-consensually. Like, I did not have any choice. I had to hear country radio because it was the only thing you could pick up in the car. It was the only thing they played at the garage where I worked. It was just there. And yet I somehow missed Kenny Rogers and Sheena Easton's version of We've Got Tonight. So there's always new things to learn, folks. That's the moral of the story. There's always more to learn. And next week we'll be talking about hip-hop in 1984. So a very interesting year with Run-DMC coming over, taking over, but you still have all the, you know, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. I think they'd broken up, but Melly Mel and the Furious Five was still going pretty strong, and you had Houdini going out there. So Curtis Blow is still a factor. So, you know, hip-hop is going to go through a switch, and we'll talk about that next week. So, Ed Legg, thanks again. And we've been discussing Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, Nate and Garrett Cash return with more of the Holy Roll series, this time discussing the Queen of Gospel, Mahalia Jackson. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.